The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Charles Arthur. I'm afraid Alex Krotowski has jetted off to the Americas, so you'll just have to make do with me in this end-of-year roundup, which also has predictions for 2013 from Jemima Kish. Joining me today in the studio is Josh Halliday, who's our technology reporter, and also down the line we have Keith Stewart, who's our games correspondent. Welcome, Josh. Welcome, Keith.
Thank you.
Hello.
So let's start with you, Josh. We're picking two subjects each, and we're just going to sort of examine them in depth and see what the year has done to them. What are your two topics today?
My first would be Microsoft. It's been an amazing year for Microsoft. They spent 11 months gearing up for the launch of Windows 8, which would be its big pivot, as it was described. I hate that word, but it was described as a big pivot for the software company. And it's been received with a mixed response from users. The tablet sales haven't really taken off. And 2 weeks after the launch, Steven Sinofsky, who was head of the Windows division and was tipped as a future leader at Microsoft, surprisingly stepped down, leaving the plans for future rollout and in somewhat disarray. It seems to have quietened down a little bit since then, in the 4 weeks since then. But all this happened, you know, in a space of a few weeks. You can't imagine what Steve Ballmer must have been thinking at the time, and it's hard to see where he's going to steer the ship next year.
There seems to have been some discussion. I saw some on geekwire.com where they looked at what Sinofsky had been writing in some blog posts about collaboration. And he was saying, he seemed to be pointing towards a company which needed more collaboration, and that he was saying collaboration needed to come from the bottom rather than the top, that you don't drive collaboration. It's actually something which is sort of innate to the company. And interestingly, he also commented in the comments there, sort of saying that, you know, emphasizing this point. It seems as though Steve Ballmer didn't really buy into what he was describing, and some people have said that Sinofsky was something of a divisive influence. Did any of that come over? Because you were at the Windows 8 launch.
I was at the Windows 8 launch in New York, and everyone there, the people that I spoke to, no one had a bad word to say about Steven Sinofsky. He was, you know, widely described as one of the most impressive speakers of the entire week. He looked really enthused at what he was saying. He looked really into the project. And so it was a massive surprise that, you know, less than a fortnight later, he'd actually left the company that he'd been at for more than two decades. He was centrally involved in the launch. He was on stage describing Windows 8 before Steve Ballmer came on and did his thing. And as soon as he stepped off stage, he marched up to Walt Mossberg of the Wall Street Journal to get his immediate feedback. So this is a man who cares passionately about Windows 8, which he's been, you know, he's been the mastermind of.
No signs of animosity between Ballmer and Sinofsky at the time?
We couldn't see any. I mean, you wouldn't see them interacting in the fringes of the conference, but I suppose that's regular. I suppose that's what happens at conferences. All the discussions go on backstage and at the hotels. There were no obvious signs of any tension or strain on Sinofsky at all. As I said, he seemed like a man genuinely enthused about what was to come for Microsoft.
So very much out of the blue, and the thing with Windows 8, of course, is that it's trying to straddle both the desktop and the laptop and the tablet space, and with the new tiled sort of top-level interface, it's trying to be a tablet interface, and yet at the same time, you can, you know, hit one of the tiles and you're down in the desktop. Keith, what's been the reaction over Windows 8 in the games world? Because I know that Notch, who's the inventor of Minecraft, said that he wouldn't rewrite Minecraft to run for Windows 8. Has he changed his mind? What's been the reaction of games developers to Windows 8?
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of controversy when Notch said that, when he made his point about Windows 8. And I think there's been concerns within the development community that this was kind of Microsoft's land grab for the digital games download sector, that Microsoft had been watching the growth of Steam and the massive success of Steam, which is Valve Software's digital download games platform and store, and wanted to essentially nick that sizable business.
Well, by having its own app store.
By having its own app store as part of Windows 8, and it looked as though games wouldn't be able to go on that store unless they supported the APIs that Microsoft were using. So it looked to some independent developers that Microsoft was essentially trying to create a walled garden around the Windows 8 App Store. And I think that's what Nat Notch was angry about. I don't think he's really changed his stance. And the problem, I think the thing is with him and with Minecraft, that he's so persuasive and such an important figure in the indie games community. I think that kind of cast a shadow over what they were trying to do with games. And there's been loads of controversy about Windows 8 and how it's going to work with games. But I still think it's really, really early days yet, to be honest, to say how it is doing with indie developers and with developers in general.
Indeed, it's still pretty early days altogether for Windows 8, so we'll have to come back in January, see how the first couple of months of sales have gone. And Josh, your second topic is Yahoo, the company that no one ever quite knows what it's for. Tell us what happened with Yahoo this year.
That's right. Yahoo this year appointed its fifth chief executive in as many years. It was a bit of a coup for Yahoo when it secured Marissa Mayer from Google to attempt to steer the ship round. She joined in July. She was pregnant at the time, wasn't she? She had a
Indeed.
Kid, I think, a few weeks later.
She sort of announced the appointment and then the pregnancy.
That's right. The woman really has no limits. It was a tumultuous year for Yahoo. Scott Thompson, the chief executive, lasted only 4 months, and he left in May after the controversy about him padding out his CV, or resume, as they say in America. And that prompted the resignation of Chairman Roy Bostock. Since Marissa Mayer joined in July, the company has settled down a little bit, it seems. And then in the past fortnight, the sort of first couple of weeks of December, we've seen what looked to be the first fruits of Marissa's immediate legacy. She's overseen a revamp of Yahoo Mail, which was starting to look a little bit stale, even though it's still got a healthy amount of users.
Mm-hmm. Nothing wrong with the 1990s, after all.
Absolutely not. And Flickr. Which, after all, you know, is a jewel in the crown of Yahoo, but which has also languished when its competitors, Instagram, now Twitter, and you know, Instagram was bought by Facebook, so they've got the resources to take on Flickr now.
The key thing, I guess, being about Flickr now, that it's a very much a mobile app. That's really what they've done with it, haven't they?
That's right, and Marissa came in and immediately said, "The future of Yahoo is mobile." The first thing she did, she's an avid Instagram user herself and a keen photographer. She has her own Flickr collection, and she wanted to put Flickr where Instagram is, or where Instagram hopes to be. After all, you know, he's got a huge loyal user base still, Flickr, of talented photographers, and I think what she's after is some of the more keen amateurs that Instagram seems to have inspired with its retro-esque filters. And so that app was launched in early December, and they've pumped a lot of resource into it.
So what do we think will be the way for Yahoo to turn itself around? Because the problem has always been that, you know, it may have Flickr and may have things like that, but no one, as I said, could quite see what it was there for, apart from just being a big billboard for adverts.
I think the problem for a few of the previous chief executives, you know, the 5 in 5 years, was that they spent a lot of time, energy and money dedicated to this core question of what is Yahoo about? And there's a time must come when you've got to put aside that question and focus on, you know, what brings in the money, do what Yahoo has always done well, and stop worrying about where its next competitors are going to come from. You know, Flickr's got the healthy user base, as we've said. Apparently the size of the Flickr team in San Francisco has doubled since Marissa Mayer joined. You know, that's only six months. And I was speaking to a few Yahoos?
Yes, I think that's the word.
Earlier this week, and they were saying how much of a brighter place the company seems to be since Marissa joined. Apparently she's overseeing a scheme where each of the company employees will get to choose an iPhone or an Android phone, you know, in the first quarter of next year.
And they used to be BlackBerry users, didn't they? That was all through Yahoo.
It's little things like that help to inspire company morale, and you know, the executives at the top can focus on what comes next year. And it's worth pointing out, actually, that it's not actually been a terrible year, although it's been a tumultuous year for Yahoo. Stock has risen 20% from where it was last year, still only $19. But, you know, it's a company that's going in the right direction, at least for now.
Thanks, Josh. And now we move on to Keith. So, Keith, tell us, what's your first topic that you thought really made a difference in 2012?
I think the big one, definitely for me, and I think for a lot of people in the industry this year, was the rise of indie games. I think indie games have been on a massive growth trajectory for the last sort of 4 or 5 years, ever since the release of, I think, maybe Jonathan Blow's game Braid in 2008. But this year, I think the combined strength of Steam as a games delivery platform, also the digital download services offered by Xbox and PlayStation, have really led to an enormous growth in the amount of very small studios and even like bedroom coders who are now making games that are not only getting some sort of attention from critics, but also getting enormous amounts of attention from consumers. We've obviously already spoken about Notch and Minecraft, but Minecraft was released on Xbox Live this year, and it's become the biggest downloadable game on the platform, and more people are playing it online than they're playing Call of Duty. So, I mean, I think that says an enormous amount about how important indie games are now. This year, for example, as well, we've seen games like Hotline Miami, which is a sort of a top-down shooter that's very much in the style of the early Grand Theft Auto games, but has a kind of real sense of its own style. It has a real 80s aesthetic about it, but it's an enormously fun game, really well designed, and it's done amazingly well.
Lots of games, but I mean, you contrasted Minecraft and Call of Duty. Which one's actually pulling in the bucks? Because I don't quite know where the financial model is in Minecraft.
Well, Minecraft's doing well. You shouldn't worry about that. The model is, and essentially, Notch introduced this model or popularized the model of a sort of paid-for beta tests. So you could pay to effectively become a beta tester for the game and download early versions of it and contribute to the development of the game. And this was the model that Minecraft set up, and lots of other games since have adopted this model. So essentially, people are almost paying to become beta testers for the product, but he's managed to amass this huge audience. And also, obviously, the Minecraft on XBLA is charged, so you pay to download that, and it's one of the most expensive games to download on Xbox, but yet it's still done amazingly well. So
this must all cause problems for the people who want to do sort of official games charts, who work with retailers to say, well, you know, how many of these games do you sell? Because if the indie games are actually being downloaded millions of times and people are actually stumping up money for them or Xbox points, how do we get a clear idea of what the chart is?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is a problem that's being faced at the moment. And you have the NPD group in the States and also ChartTrack in the UK that are finding really that, based on retail sales, they're only getting a small sort of percentage, and in fact a declining percentage of what game sales actually are. And you often see a lot of figures, especially at this time of the year, that are saying game sales are down, and it leads to this kind of idea that less people are playing games, which couldn't be further from the truth. In fact, it's just that the delivery methods have changed, and now lots of people are downloading games rather than buying games in the shops, and it's kind of skewed the whole industry.
Is there any sign that they'll actually get their act together next year and start to have a chart with the downloads as well?
Yeah, I mean, that's happening now, but I think it's complicated because there's so many different delivery pipelines for games to go through. It doesn't work in the same way as retail because there's lots of different digital download stores and there's lots of different ways of getting these games. So it's much more difficult, I think, to get solid, reliable data. But all this, while this is happening, we're getting amazing games like Spelunky and Fez and Super Hexagon that are sort of changing the face of gaming, and that's not being reflected in the sales charts, but it's certainly being reflected in how people are playing and buying games.
So that's the software side. What about hardware?
We've had two hardware launches this year. Obviously, we had the PlayStation Vita at the start of the year in February, and we've just had the Wii U launch. The Wii U launched in America first. It shifted about 400,000 units, apparently. We had the European launch then, and it's just this week launched in Japan, and again, it's done around 385,000 units, which is slightly less than the original Wii, but still pretty good, considering I think Nintendo's going to have a harder job of telling people exactly what the unique selling points of Wii U are.
Are we ready to bury the PS Vita yet? Because a lot of people thought that it was really not selling very well.
I don't think it is. I think Vita is one of those... It was a kind of extraordinary decision from Sony, I think. We've discussed this before on the podcast, but it's an absolutely beautiful piece of hardware. It's it's a piece of hardware which has almost the most user interfaces of anything you've ever seen. It's got a touchscreen on the front, a touchscreen on the back. It's got lots of analog sticks. It's got lots of buttons. Developers love it. It's very powerful. It's got a beautiful screen. But at the same time, obviously, you have the rise of smartphones, and Sony has its own video game smartphone initiative. It's got the PlayStation Mobile platform, which is available on Android devices. So Sony has kind of it's got its fingers in the smartphone pie, but it's also tried to release this very specialist and quite expensive piece of hardware that developers love. But yes, it's not selling, and I don't think we're ready to bury it yet. But I think it's on the hospital ward, looking a bit sickly.
Okay, what about the Wii U then? I mean, you said you think Nintendo's got a problem trying to explain what its USP is. What is its USP, and is there any reason why anyone should actually buy it?
Yeah, I mean, the USP is definitely the gamepad, which is this tablet-like controller, which provides a separate screen to go alongside what you're watching on the television. So there's certain games which use it to allow one player. I mean, the key benefit is this whole idea of asymmetrical multiplayer. So you'll have four of you in a room playing a game, three of you watching the telly, but one of you will be having a different experience watching the small screen on their gamepad. And so it'll often be, I think what it does is it actually goes back to the era of almost of like Victorian charades and, you know, parlor games, because you've got one person who's it and he's playing against the others. So it's a really different sense of playing, and just the fact that I find it very difficult to describe what the games are like indicates how difficult it's going to be for Nintendo to market this thing. But this whole idea of asymmetric multiplayer and having two screens, I think, is really interesting. And I've been playing Wii U with my sons over the last week, and they've been absolute hysterics, because they love that there's a, on Nintendo Land, which is pretty much the killer app, it's a series of 12 very small mini games, and they're all around this idea of one person trying to do something different from everyone else and everyone competing against each other. And they're really funny, and they're really, as typically for Nintendo, they're beautifully designed. I think the challenge for Nintendo going forward is showing people these games, developing this idea of asymmetric multiplayer, and appealing to people in the way that the Wii did, without having to rely on that, you know, that Wii remote motion controller, which everyone kind of grasped really quickly and really understood it very quickly. I think the gamepad and Wii U have some really lovely aspects to them, but I think it's going to be tricky for Nintendo, especially heading into 2013, when we're going to get PlayStation 4 and Xbox 720 announced.
Thanks very much, Keith. For this and more stories, go to guardian.co.uk/technology. Okay, so we come to my choices of the stories of the year. And I think that it would be impossible, really, to talk about the year in technology without looking at what's happened in smartphones. And we've seen two simultaneous changes. There's been the fall of Nokia and RIM and the rise of Apple and Samsung. The fall of Nokia and RIM, to the extent that both companies started out this year and have continued this year, making losses financially, and seeing the number of phones that they've been shipping in the smartphone sector shrink. And we're just about expecting to get some results from RIM later this week. And those, again, are expected to show a loss. Meanwhile, Apple and Samsung have just kept on rising, to the extent that they now make up half of all the smartphone shipments in the world, in a segment which is growing at about 40% year on year. Of those, Samsung has about, I think, two-thirds or so of that 50%. They're much larger than Apple in terms of smartphone sales. Equally, they're a bit cloaked in mystery, because no one actually knows exactly what the numbers are. They don't seem to be obliged by the South Korean Stock Exchange to give these sorts of numbers, whereas Apple does give numbers and prices, so you know exactly how much each iPhone sells for on average. And it seems to indicate that it's the latest iPhones which are the ones that are selling well. So looking at the way that the smartphone business has gone, it seems to me that we're heading very much towards a sort of two-horse race. Windows Phone 8 and Windows Phone generally hasn't managed to take off. Nokia hasn't made a great success of it, despite launching its first Windows Phone devices a year ago and having new devices through this year. It's still selling more Symbian phones in the third quarter than it was Windows Phone devices. And that seems to be an enduring problem. It just can't get any traction. Part of that is down to the amount of money that people like Samsung are spending actually on marketing. The marketing spend by Samsung is absolutely colossal. It's in the multiple billions of dollars every quarter. Horace Dedieu of Simco did some analysis which showed that when you factor in things like the Olympics and all the other sponsorship and marketing spend that Samsung does, it's outspending Apple by a factor of about 8 to 1. And that's when people think that Apple is big on marketing. Equally, RIM has a big problem coming up, which is, can I get people to buy BlackBerry 10? I mean, Josh, you were just talking about Yahoo giving people the encouragement of, hey, you can have an Android or an iPhone, and dumping their BlackBerries. I mean, do you think that RIM is ever going to dig itself out of this hole?
It's hard to see a way back for RIM, isn't it? I mean, it seems to have lost the enterprise. All it's got going for it, surprisingly, is seemingly still the cool factor among people who like to BBM. The rise of WhatsApp on the iPhone might soon see the end of that. But BBM, I don't know whether RIM ever truly realised how important or pivotal BBM would be for its future. It might be the one thing that others are still trying to catch up on. WhatsApp is the closest direct competitor to that. But it's hard to see a way back for RIM in terms of the enterprise. With Yahoo, there wasn't even the choice of a BlackBerry handset for employees on the table, and that says a lot, I think.
It's intriguing. I think that Marissa Mayer came from Google, which of course is the home of Android, and she was an iPhone user, and her use of Instagram sort of points to that. She's a sort of a cuckoo in the nest in that respect. But yes, certainly BlackBerry has lost some important US government contracts. Its share in the US consumer market has been falling into the low single digits. And yet there are emerging economies where it's popular. I mean, in Nigeria, having a BlackBerry is a sort of a status symbol.
It will find these markets that where it's still popular. It's just, are they going to be enough to see a long-term future for RIM? It's hard to see that at the minute.
Do you think that Samsung has been underrated? Because, I mean, you used to be a Samsung Galaxy user yourself. You're actually now using a Windows Phone device. You've got a Nokia, I think it is.
I am, ahead of the curve.
Do you think people have underrated Samsung's position in the market generally?
I think Samsung has overstated its own position in terms of the marketing spend. It's absolutely extraordinary what it's spending compared to Apple. And it's not hard really to see why Nokia might have struggled to compete with that. It simply has been drowned out by the marketing messages of Samsung, and perhaps there's an argument that it has laboured under its old, it's slightly uncool, dumb phone image of yesteryear. But I think Samsung has had a bit of a problem with the PR problem with over the patents with Apple as well. It seems to have the message that Apple was putting across that Samsung is just copying the iPhone has stuck in some quarters, and I think there might be some it's cruel, but there might be some perception in some quarters that Samsung phones really are just a poor man's iPhone, and if you want the full package, you've just got to go for an iPhone. It's as simple as that.
It's interesting because there's some sentiment that Apple's aggressive pursuit of Samsung this year over the past couple of years over patents has hurt Apple. So possibly it's something that's hurt both companies equally.
I don't think anyone ever comes out of legal battles or skirmishes like this fully unscathed.
Lots more to come in the year ahead. And speaking of the year ahead, here's Jemima Kish with her predictions for 2013.
Facebook had an interesting year, obviously, with a slightly wobbly IPO, but I think we really need to watch what it's doing with its paid-for posts. There's quite a lot of dissent among marketers who now don't get the reach that they had with organic posts. And for people who aren't really small businesses, people who are maybe bands and expect to be able to reach everyone who likes them, that's a really big turnaround. They're reaching in some cases, only 5% of the people they were reaching before. So we could see a real backlash there. That's a really interesting area to watch. Twitter, more angst among third-party developers, especially those who are quite dependent or wholly dependent on Twitter for their businesses. We've already had one court case last month from a company who is trying to sue Twitter for cutting off the fire hose. I think we'll see more action like that. And I think slightly separately, we could also start to see politicians make noises about regulating Twitter. I don't think they'll actually be able to do it, but I think they will start feeling the need in the wake of the Leveson media inquiry to at least express an interest in how they can have more control over social media. So that will be interesting to watch. Google, I have to say one of my New Year's resolutions is to have yet another go at Google Plus, which has just not stuck for me. But yesterday I asked people what their favourite social networking communication platform is, and I was absolutely besieged by people. I think there must have been an organised campaign, but I was besieged by Google Plus fans. If there is a little bit of a backlash against Facebook, then it's possible that people who prefer a slightly longer form, more in-depth kind of social networking will shift over to Google Plus, possibly. So, one to watch. Next, photo sharing. I had a very interesting chat with Blaine Cook recently, a former Twitter developer who's now working on a startup in London. He made a great observation that despite the huge amount of potential in the crossover between photography and social media, there's so little innovation. The innovation seems to extend to doing an app with filters on it. we're really missing a trick here. So I would really hope that in the area of photo sharing, we see a little bit more creativity and invention. Similarly, I was thinking logically about what has been done in the spaces of apps and messaging services in specific media. So we have Twitter for text, Audioboo for sound, Instagram for images, 6thread for video messaging. What do we have for data? And I wonder if this is a very interesting space to watch as well. As data becomes more mainstream, as people become more interested in monitoring their life online, are we going to see a really accessible way of people measuring their kind of online life in a kind of in a way that you can chop and dice through an app?
Is that the online life or your sort of your physical life but measured online? Because it seems to me there's certainly a very interesting movement, which of course has started in California, of sort of measuring what hour did you get up, how many miles have you run, how fast did you run it, can you put it all in there, how do you compare yourself against last week, last month, last year, you know, how much have you eaten today, did you take a photograph, where did you take a photograph, you know, where have you been, all this sort of stuff, which is you know, just starting really, I think, to permeate more broadly, yeah, with things like Nike Plus. But also there's the analyze what you've done. So there's lots of, I think there's a growing number of apps which will say, you know, when did you send an email? When did you tweet? Who did you tweet to? You know, all these sorts of things. And I wonder if there's not some sort of mashup almost coming in there of, you know, where were you when you interacted with all these people and where's the place where you interact the most with? Which your answer is obviously at home in the office, but...
Two thoughts there. One is that the extension of things like running apps is the Internet of Things. Hmm. So ultimately your house will be controlled from an app and you can, you know, put the central heating on an hour before you get home.
I just said
the other is that there is already the germ of an idea in data visualization and monitoring. I know there's a great startup called TickTrack that is doing just that, a kind of dashboard for your personal information. And I think there's a possibility they might even hook up with, you know, your, ultimately they would like to hook up with your local GP or certainly the health service. So, yeah, huge potential in that area. Mobile video. We have 4G. We know from Ofcom's recent report that the UK are massive users of the internet and of the mobile internet. In fact, more than anyone else in Europe. Which combined with a particular appetite for video, according to the statistics in this country, would seem to suggest that there's an even bigger opportunity for mobile video in the next year. If you look at the next generation, probably your very own children, in fact, Charles, They are fearless with using video. They don't think twice about video phone messaging, about doing, in fact, Tom Daly is very good at this, but he's always tweeting little video messages of what he's been up to. I think our generation are a little bit more reserved, but that's just going to become more and more ubiquitous. Video tagging, I'd put money on this becoming massive in the next year or two. Great startup called Kiosked, and another one called Wirewax. Facebook photo tagging has kind of trained people up in being familiar with a little, very nicely designed tag on photos. What Kiosked and Wirewax, and probably a few others do, is they put that kind of tag onto videos. So for retail, that's going to be massive. And I think also for publishers, that could be really key as well. Another nice little trend is long-form content. Actually, Bobby Johnson, formerly of this parish, managed to get, I think it was $140,000, $150,000 funding through Kickstarter for Matter, which does kind of off-piste long-form content. There's also Delayed Gratification magazine, been around for a few years, and Uncool, which is a US music magazine. But very interesting sort of kickback to the very fast-paced nature of the internet, I think. So,
Do you think that long form is driven a little bit by people having mobiles actually and having journeys and reading things on a longer journey, that it's easier to read those long form things than it might be, say, if you're sitting around at home where you might have more distractions?
Yeah, I think it's very tablet friendly, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Certainly for commuters as well. I know I quite often pull off kind of longer pieces to read on the train. But yeah, I think there's also a kind of human thing in there, that we're sort of getting a bit tired of skipping around over the internet all the time, and we're all a bit bored of kind of bish bash bosh hamster wheel blogs as well, which kind of relentlessly bombard you with information all the time. Lastly, I've had a bit of an epiphany with the new MySpace, which I think is the best interface I've used in a very long time. It does have the disadvantage that, for obvious reasons, they don't seem to want to let you import your Twitter or Facebook friends.
Possibly they're not allowed to by Twitter or Facebook.
Well, that would be it then. But it's absolutely beautiful. It's such an amazing experience, and I'm really impressed. It's kind of unencumbered by the Murdoch association of past. So I would love it in a kind of deeply ironic way if MySpace then became the big thing of 2013. And likewise, going back to the old school, Yahoo is starting to look really impressive. I spoke to a VC today who really, really is completely convinced that their share price is going to double by the end of next year. Obviously, it's pretty low at the moment, but don't underestimate Marissa Mayer. I mean, she's a very smart cookie. She's very product-focused. There's a huge buzz in Silicon Valley about the Mail app, and obviously the Flickr app came out as well, but if anyone can pick Yahoo up, I think it's her. So, yeah, ending with a bit of the old school Yahoo and MySpace, but we'll have to listen to this again in 12 months' time and see how we did.
Indeed. Thank you very much, Jemima Kish. And that's all from us today. Thank you for listening. We'll be back with you next year. This is Charles Arthur from The Guardian. You can catch up with all our technology stories at guardian.co.uk/technology. Until 2013, goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.